It is 7:31, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Carl Meyer. Carl Meyer is an attorney and consumer advocate. He has dedicated his law practice, writing, and electoral work to the end of corporate power over the rights of citizens. He has authored or contributed to writings including Shakedown, The Fleecing of the Garden State, Public Domain, Private Dominion, The Lawyer's Desk Book on White-Collar Crime, and Personalizing the Impersonal, Corporations and the Bill of Rights. In addition, Carl Meyer has also worked on the Nike versus Caskey case in the United States Supreme Court that successfully prevented Nike from using the First Amendment to continue deceiving consumers about sweatshop labor used in Nike manufacturing plants. Carl, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate your having me, and I've heard all over town that you're the go-to man for the cutting-edge issues in Seattle, so it's a real honor to be here.
Thank you. Let's start out and tell us, how did you get involved in these issues?
Well, it really, the first time I got involved was many years ago when I was a student at Princeton University, and I heard about the issue of universities and corporations investing in the Republic of South Africa, which at the time was an apartheid regime. And many American companies at that time were providing resources to the racist South African government. And those resources allowed the South African government to run their apartheid system. For example, IBM provided to South Africa the computer system, which allowed them to run their pass, what was called a pass system, which would give the blacks in South Africa basically an identity card, almost similar to the star that they put on Jews in Nazi Germany. And you couldn't move anywhere in South Africa without that identity card, and they kept tight tabs on the workers going in and out. The General Motors supplied the South African military with vehicles and other armaments that were used to quell any efforts to end apartheid in South Africa. So at the time, the students believed that we really shouldn't be having university resources invested in companies that were propping up the racist apartheid regime. And at the time, you know, sometimes student activists think that what they do doesn't matter or why get involved. And we would have representatives of Nelson Mandela come over to us and say, you know, for students, you may think that what you're doing doesn't matter, but we can tell you in South Africa, when the students march in the United States, it's on the front pages of our newspapers, and we recognize it there, so keep it up. And, you know, people all over the nation kept it up, and it was really, even though at the time we never got Princeton University to divest, a lot of other universities did divest and wouldn't do business with corporations that supported the racist regime. However, eventually Congress passed an act after an enormous student pressure, and they cut off all investments with the racist regime until eventually Nelson Mandela was released from prison and they became a democratic nation. And so that really showed me that you can achieve change through citizen action, and I think students should take that message to heart, that they can do very important things with their time if they set their minds to it. So that's how I first came to question what corporations were doing with the resources that Americans give them. And so I've been questioning what corporations have been doing ever since.
Well, if you would give us a kind of brief history of corporate personhood, the act of corporations getting the rights of humans, or citizens in this case.
Right. Well, what I've done a lot in my scholarly writing, and I'll try to make this accessible. I'm for example, I'm talking to the University of Seattle Law School on Wednesday, and the public radio wanted to cover it, so they called up the dean, and they said, "We'd like to cover Carl Meyer's talk. We just want to make sure that his talk's not going to be one of those academic wonkish talks." So I assured him, no, we'll we'll keep it accessible. It won't be an academic wonkish talk. But so in response to your question, the question is what is the role of corporations in American society? That's the overriding issue. And at the beginning of the Republic, when our nation was first founded, corporations were seen as arms of the British government, of the Crown. The British East India Company was seen as an arm, not just an arm of the government, but through its charter, it was given a monopoly often on trade in the United States. And in fact, if you review the historic records, the Boston Tea Party was not just about a tax on tea. It was about protesting the monopoly that was given to the British East India Company over trade in the colonies. So very much a part of the American Revolution was not just to fight the tyranny of George III. It was to fight the tyranny of corporate power in the colonies. And that is why when the nation was first founded, the revolutionists changed the nature of what the corporation should be up to. So after the revolution, this country imposed very strict conditions on what corporations could do and could not do, because they didn't want to replicate the British experience of giving too much power to corporate institutions like the British East India Company and giving monopoly power to corporations. So the earliest charters that were given to corporations were very limited in duration. They were limited to, say, a 10-year period. The corporation only existed for a particular purpose, for example, building a railroad, building a canal. And it was very clear the corporations were designed to be our servants, not our masters. The corporations were designed to serve the American population in a limited fashion. Well, as the years went on, that changed. What happened was that throughout the course of the 19th century, enterprises and business people engaged in commerce, corporations became larger, so there was a greater and greater effort to go to the various legislatures and change the way that corporations are chartered by citizens. Because remember, when you charter a corporation, you're giving it enormous privileges and enormous, in effect, subsidies. So what they were doing was they were going to these legislatures and they were saying, we want corporations that are have perpetual life. We want corporations that can engage in any type of commerce. And in many cases, they wanted subsidies. And they got all of the above, the best example being the Standard Oil Trust, which, you know, the trust concept was actually wholly foreign to American corporate law at that point. And what that did was it allowed the Standard Oil Company to merge many different industries, which previously could not because of limited corporate charters, merge together. Then the corporate laws were all changed in the various legislatures, and corporations became more and more giant behemoths. Now, at the same time, a parallel development was in the I'm talking about going what happened in the legislature at that time. A parallel development was occurring in the Supreme Court and in the court system. That parallel development began to grant corporations under the Constitution the same rights as individuals, as the so-called corporate personhood, which is what you started the question with. And corporate personhood means that the corporation is nowhere mentioned in the American Constitution, right? Remember, the preamble to the Constitution begins, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, provide for the general welfare," talks about justice. Several provisions of the Constitution talk about persons, but there's no mention of corporations, which is important because the framers never the framers very much knew about corporations, but they never saw fit to embed them in the language of the Constitution. So what has happened ever since the 19th century is, talk about judicial activism. This is mega judicial activism on steroids, right? And you never hear the right wing talk about this. You never hear Republicans talk about it. You'll only hear a Democrat talk about it once in a blue moon, if you're lucky. But this opinion, which was crafted in 1866, it was Santa Clara Railroad, the Supreme Court decision, just ruled that corporations are persons for purposes of the United States Constitution. So that was it, mega judicial activism, ipso facto, corporations had all of these new rights. They had, for example, 14th Amendment rights, which allow If there are laws passed by the state, for example, to control corporate power, it allows the corporations to go into court and challenge those restrictions on corporate power. So over time, all of the Bill of Rights protections that you and I have, the First Amendment right to speak, corporations have, and whenever there is an attempt to restrict corporate advertising, say tobacco advertising to minors, tobacco billboards, there's always a challenge now under the Constitution based on those original corporate personhood opinions. Yeah, interestingly, for example, the 14th Amendment was designed, it was passed right after the Civil War, and it was passed to protect the newly freed slaves in the United States. Basically, what the 14th Amendment did was it was intended to allow the newly freed African Americans to challenge any state laws that would, for example, restrict them from voting, put a poll tax on, restrict their property holdings, whatever. In the years from the end of the Civil War right up until the New Deal, however, fully 75% of the cases brought in the federal court system were brought not by newly freed African Americans. They were brought by corporations to protect their property rights to forestall against government regulation. So that's the situation we have right up until the present day. I'll give you another perspective, since the title of the show is Mind Over Matter. Think about this one. Get your mind around this one. There's the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution is the one that prohibits the government from unreasonable searches and seizures. It prohibits the government from going into your house, for example, without a warrant. Well, we've seen recently that the Bush administration has seen fit to conduct searches without a warrant, in other words, wiretaps without a warrant. However, under a 1977 Supreme Court opinion, it's called Marshall versus Barlow's, Inc., corporations have Fourth Amendment protections. So that means that their factories, their plants, can't be searched by warrantless searches from the government. So in other words, if OSHA wants to go in and search a corporate plant in a surprise inspection, they can't do it. No surprise inspections because the corporations are using. And you would think that in the area of safety, you might want some surprise inspections because you've got over 200,000 Americans that perish in the mines in the last few years. You'd want surprise inspections of all these workplaces. So now you have a situation where warrantless wiretaps on individuals, blessed by the Bush administration, and we'll see what the courts do with them. Warrantless surprise inspections on corporate property to protect health and safety, can't do it. So you see the imbalance in power that the legal system is creating.
So the situation, I remember a few years ago with, I think it was Tyson Foods that had a factory down in the South that burnt down, and they had had their fire doors like padlocked because they didn't want their employees taking breaks, basically.
Right.
So in that situation, OSHA couldn't have gone in to do a surprise inspection.
Not a surprise inspection. And they have to get a warrant, and that typically alerts the company to what's happening. OSHA can't do it. You know, in fact, the companies went so far, Dow Chemical in a 1970s case, they went so far as to bring a Supreme Court challenge to the EPA, which had planes that would just fly over Dow Chemical plants to see if the emissions were violating the Clean Air Act. So you can see that corporations are using these tools more and more to thwart what remains of government regulation. And as you know, the Bush administration, and to some extent the prior Democratic administration, has really taken the regulatory cop off the beat. There is much less regulation of corporate power these days than there was years ago. So the other thing I'm going to be getting into in my talk tonight is my experiences fighting corporate power in my home state of New Jersey, because I think what I'm bringing to the discussion this evening excuse me, is not just an academic perspective, which I think is it's important to think about the theory of the corporation and how corporations are using the courts to turn the Constitution against Americans, but I've had practical experiences fighting corporate power on the ground. And I want to say my message to the citizens of Washington State is that you can do it. You can fight corporate power. It just takes a little determination and willingness to spend some time. My original foray into this field was when I was I was elected as a town councilman in the town of Princeton, New Jersey. I was elected as an independent, which I want to commend to anyone. There's no greater pleasure than beating at the polls the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, who mostly take their campaign cash from the same masters. There's no greater pleasure in life than beating the two of them. And I think that in virtually any small town in this country, and even some of the big ones, citizens can do it. They can they can get elected on a third-party ticket at a local level just by the way I did it. You strap on your sneakers, you run door to door, you talk to the citizens, you work on what's important and what's on your mind, and they'll give you a chance. It's harder at the national level because of all the corporate cash that flows into these campaigns. So in any event, the way I started on the more practical aspect of fighting corporations, if you will, as opposed to the theoretical, is I was on the town council in Princeton, and the first letter I received in the mail was an invitation to go down to Atlantic City to the casinos, where there would be a statewide convention of all elected officials in Atlantic City. And all the elected officials in the state would be there. And there are 535 municipalities in New Jersey, so that's a lot of elected officials. And the statewide elected officials would be there, and the congressional delegation. Ostensibly, the purpose of this was to educate the elected officials in important issues of government. But what I found when I got there was that really it was set up in the casinos in the convention hall. It's actually in the hall that Miss America is crowned. But there is there was miles and miles, acres of corporate interests who were there pitching their products to every level of government. And there was, for example, Mobil had a little booth there, Mobil Oil Company, and they had a fish tank. And in the fish tank, this guy was pouring Mobil oil into the fish tank to show local officials how safe the oil was for for the environment. And there were giveaways, there were handouts. So, you know, I didn't see much education going on, to tell you the truth. There was one seminar that I went to that was entitled Hazardous Waste and You, Perfect Together, which was a takeoff on New Jersey's slogan, which was New Jersey and you perfect together. And it was all about how they had a program to pay municipalities to take nuclear waste, low-level radioactive waste. And they were pitching to the municipalities, they were trying to find a municipality that would be dumb enough to take the low-level radioactive waste. So just on a lark, I went up to the representative from the nuclear industry and I said, "Hey, you know, I'm from Princeton. We'd really like to consider having some low-level radioactive waste. How much are you guys going to pay us?" And he gave me the number. You know, it's like $5 million. It's a big boost to the local economy. And I said, "Well, what do you think? You think Princeton's your town for town for the job?" And he just looked at me and he looked around. And he said, "Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you, Carl, off the record. They're too smart and they're too wealthy in Princeton. I don't think your people will go for this." Basically saying, we're looking for a poor town where we can take advantage of the people, give them the money, dump the waste there. Okay, so I got back up to Princeton and I said, "I cannot believe this is going on." And not only that, I didn't add Mike to boot. This whole junket, hootenanny fiesta was paid for by the taxpayer. Yeah. I decided to go down on my own nickel. But everyone there, from the lobbyists to the politicians, on the taxpayer. So I got back. I wrote it up for the New York Times. The New York Times did an editorial. Next thing I know, apparently Morley Safer was lounging around one summer afternoon. He read this thing in the New York Times. And he called me up. He said, "You know, Carl, we'd really like to do an undercover thing with you to see how some of this corporate power stuff works in American politics. Would you be willing to go undercover with us?" You know, well, you know, he had the right man, a former anti-apartheid activist, Ralph Nader worker right after college. So I didn't hesitate. Sure, I'll go. So we went. They had undercover cameras whirling, and we went down to Atlantic City the next year, and actually they had some cameras that were not undercover as well who went with us. So we got the undercover footage first. Then the last day of shooting, they had the real cameras came out, and we went to one of these booths. And one of these booths was a booth that was established by a company called United Gunite, which is a sewer. What they do is they repair sewers and they do concrete. They had a big wheel, like a wheel of fortune, and they had a scantily clad woman who was spinning the wheel, and and all the elected officials would go, and they would pick a number, and if it landed on your number, you'd get a prize from the company, which is not a bad prize. So the cameraman came up from 60 Minutes and started filming this. And as soon as he did, the president of the company comes over. He tries to stand in front of the camera, and he whips out of his pocket a $100 bill and gives it to the cameraman. And the producer, the producer freaked out. He said, "What do I do? You know, no one's ever handed me money not to film before. In the history of 60 Minutes, it never had." So he finally did the right thing, is he handed it back, and he filmed it, right? And sure enough, this piece came out, and it showed how, people were, the lobbyists were just partying like crazy with the politicians. They were doing everything they could to influence them. They had another event, which we went on, which is this train that the Chamber of Commerce, they take over an entire Amtrak train, and they turn every car into a bar car, and all the lobbyists, all of the important state elected officials and the lobbyists jam on this train, and they ride down to Washington for the annual Chamber of Commerce dinner. It's called the gravy train, the corporate gravy train, but they call it the walk to Washington. People are completely inebriated. On the train, they just offer any elected official. Like, I got offered a cruise in the Caribbean, golf outings to Scotland, just for being an independent, just a low-level town councilman, right? So all this was on 60 Minutes. They had the undercover guy in the train. They had a helicopter following the train. It was terrific. It was a terrific piece. It aired many years ago. It aired 10 years ago. And naive me, I thought maybe after airing this, we'll get some changes. Well, they're still riding that train today. They're still riding that train. They're still having those sessions down in Atlantic City. But one good thing that did come out of it, which I'm going to talk about tonight, is the man who was bribing the cameramen not to film. Is the CEO of the cement company. His name was Jerry Free. Someone over at the U.S. Attorney's Office, they must have seen this on, I can imagine the conversation in the federal prosecutor's office the next morning. Oh, did you see last night? There was some guy on national television was bribing a 60 Minutes camera crew. Maybe we should do something about that. That's not good for our image here in New Jersey, is it? So sure enough, the FBI and the U.S. attorney went down the next year, and they followed this man around. And it turned out what he was doing, the CEO of United Gunite Company, was he was giving the $100 bill he was giving to the 60 Minutes cameraman was nothing. He was giving packages of cash, tens of thousands of dollars, to mayors all over the state of New Jersey. And in return, he would get government contracts for his company. So I'll tell you exactly how the deal worked in one town. For example, there's a town called Paterson, pretty medium sized city in the state of New Jersey. And what the FBI, after following Jerry Free and United Gunite Company around, they found that in the course of just 2 years, his company provided the mayor with over $200,000 in cash gifts, airline tickets to Rio de Janeiro, London. Sometimes they would do construction on a mayor's house, all sorts of things. Total of $200,000. In return, United Gunite received $17 million of contracts with the city of Paterson on a no-bid basis, right? Now, look at that rate of return. $17 million contract for a $200,000 investment. Even on Wall Street, you can't get returns like that. And so, Eventually, the FBI got this man to cooperate because they had him dead to rights, did a plea deal, And eventually over 75 elected officials and lobbyists in New Jersey have gone to prison out of that corruption, embezzlement, conspiracy to bribe investigation that was launched out of the 60 Minutes piece I did. So unfortunately, we don't have as much change as we need in the state of New Jersey by far. In fact, arguably, politics has gotten worse in terms of the corporate influence in the state of New Jersey. But at least we were able to stop some of the most egregious excesses of corporate bribery. So, you know, my message is a dual one to the citizens of Washington State. If you stand up and act as a whistleblower and act to challenge corporate power, you can achieve results. But the other part of the message is there's a lot more work to do. Now, one of my other messages is that no matter how bad Washingtonians think politics is in the state of Washington, it's not nearly as bad as New Jersey. So you can go home to your you can go home today to your friends and loved ones and say, "Whoa, I thought politics was really bad here, but you should hear what goes on in the state of New Jersey." And New Jersey has developed this national reputation for being one of the most corrupt states in the nation. And the reason that I think it's important for the citizens of Washington to know about what goes on there is because New Jersey is the future of American politics if we don't stop corporate power throughout the United States. Because New Jersey is, in many respects, the most corporate-dominated state government and local system in the country. There are more Fortune 500 headquarters there than virtually any place else except New York. There more CEOs live in this one concentrated area, Somerset County, than anywhere else in the country. And the corporations which run politics in the state have taken the level of corruption in the state to such a high level that that it should serve as a warning to citizens around the country. So I like to say that I'm sort of like the ghost of the Christmas future in Dickens' story, The Christmas Carol. I want to relay to people the dangers of corporate power and how it plays out in the state of New Jersey so that people can understand it and make certain that it doesn't happen in their own state. So, for example, I'll just tell you some of the things that are going on in the state of New Jersey. We had the last two statewide elected officials, the governor and the U.S. senator, resigned because they were taking corrupt bribes from corporate lobbyists. So we've achieved resignations, but we still haven't achieved wholesale reform. My message to the citizens of Washington State is that you can achieve wholesale reform. If you want to, there are states around this country, for example, Arizona, Vermont, Maine, they have in place what's called the Clean Elections Law, which completely takes the private money out of politics. It's a public finance system, but to qualify for it, all you need several hundred small donations of $5, and then you get publicly funded. And if someone tries to come in and buy the election with corporate money, that money is matched by the public system. So it totally nullifies the advantage of the corporate money in the system. And you could pass that through initiative and referenda here in Washington State. And it's one of the many reforms that I think is needed around the country and that we can achieve. My other message is that throughout American history, movements have grown up in the Progressive Era, in the New Deal Era, to challenge corporate power. It's been many years since we've had a sustained challenge to corporate power, but it's part of the fabric of our history. In fact, Jefferson and the Anti-Federalist Party was originally created to challenge the notion of Hamilton and the Federalists that Wall Street and large companies always did things in the best interests of the country. We know now that's not the case. We just have to band together and fight against excessive concentration of corporate power.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you. It went like lightning.
It always flies by. Been talking with Carl Meyer. He is an attorney and consumer advocate. He is going to be speaking at multiple venues. And if you need more details on any of this, you can get it from the Sound Democracy website. That's sounddemocracy.org.